Hello and welcome to the Open Source Security Podcast with myself, Kurt Seyfried, and my partner in thought crime, Josh Bressers.
Oh man, you sounded off, Kurt. He tells me he's feeling better, but anyway, I am very excited. Today we have Brian Fox, the co-founder and CTO of Sonatype, and Donald Fisher, the co-founder and CEO of Tidelift, here to talk us about some reports their respective organizations published. And I know when we talked about the Tidelift report, we said that if Tidelift would like to come and talk about their report, they are more than welcome to. And so we got kind of a two-for-one special here. So I'm really excited. Hi, Brian and Donald, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having us.
Awesome. Awesome. All right. So let's just get started. So I said Brian's name first. So Donald, I'm going to pick on you. So Tidelift put out a report. Tell us about it.
Yeah. So this was our third state of the open source maintainer report, our third iteration of doing this. We've been doing this for the last couple of years. And basically what we're doing is surveying a broad array of open source maintainers, independent open source maintainers, about their work, how they fund their work, who pays for it, what kind of work they're doing around their open source projects, especially around some timely topics like security practices and maintenance, et cetera. And then we also poll them about some kind of ripped from the headlines topics. You know, for example, this year we asked them about things like the XD Utils hack that happened earlier in 2024. What's their perception of what's happening with AI assisted tools? So that's the focus of the survey. And we had more than 400 independent open source maintainers participate this year. So we got a pretty interesting read on the sort of supply side of open source software.
Nice. And this is very much what Tidelift does, right? Give us the nickel tour of Tidelift.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I'm one of the co-founders and CEO of Tidelift. And basically what we're about is working directly with a large number of independent open source maintainers behind widely used open source packages, principally at the application development level. So you think about like JavaScript, Java, Python packages that you pull into your application software bill of materials. And what we do is we work with those maintainers and we actually pay them, create an economic incentive for them to follow specific secure development practices and validate the practices that they're following so that the organizations who are consuming all that stuff, financial services institutions, government agencies, et cetera, can have confidence in the practices that are going into that open source that they incorporate into their code. And when we work with the maintainers this way, our model is we basically enter into a contract with these maintainers where they agree to follow these practices on an ongoing basis into the future on a continual basis to sort of bring these packages up to a defined standard and then hold them there across future releases and, you know, work with us to resolve things that come up like security vulnerabilities or issues like that.
Awesome. And then that ties into Brian and Sonatype because your report is a little more consumption focused. So Brian, tell us about Sonatype and tell us about your report.
So Sonatype is the company that runs Maven Central Repository, which is where all the Java open source components are consumed worldwide. We also provide Nexus Repository Manager. There's an open source version of it, and there are hundreds of thousands of instances of that running worldwide. Nexus proxies, among other things, besides Java, NPM, Python, Docker, Conan, Ruby, NuGet, and probably a couple I forgot. And then Sonatype also provides applications to manage the software supply chain, software composition analysis and supply chain management. We've done that for, you know, like 15 years at this point. And so, nice. You know, through the combination of our ability to see exactly what's going on with consumption patterns on Maven Central, as well as telemetry from all those nexuses out there proxying more than just Java, and the ability to look at trends inside of enterprises with thousands of customers, understanding what enterprises are doing with their dependencies, we take all of that data and we provide it in a sort of a yearly report. So this year was the 10th annual State of the Software Supply Chain Report. And, you know, each year we try to do a deep dive in a different direction and try to look at different heuristics for project quality, component quality, you know, consumption patterns, those types of things. This year, given that it was the 10-year, we actually did sort of a 10-year retrospective and we looked at how did the main actors in our ecosystem evolve over 10 years? When we looked at the attackers, we looked at the publishers, and that's the part that intersected with the Tidelift data. We always look at consumers, you know, organizations pulling down open source. And then also we looked at regulators, because hint, consumers aren't doing a good enough job fast enough. So regulators are kind of stepping in to do as they do and push things forward. So that's kind of what we do. And that's what the report was all about.
Nice. All right. I have to ask, because this, I know this is in your report and you have the number. How many Log4Shell downloads are still vulnerable? Or I'm sorry, how many Log4j downloads are still vulnerable to Log4Shell?
13%. I don't know the exact number, but it's millions. So 13%, which I don't know, depends on which side you look at. Given that last year it was 30%, 13% sounds good. But I mean, come on. We're 3 years past the most notorious vulnerable component in our ecosystem, one that's been on the top 10 nation state attack vector list for the last 3 years. Something that was relatively easy to update, something that every customer was asking their vendors if they upgraded or not, you know, and this is a unique scenario where not every vulnerability should be patched every time, right? It doesn't always apply universally. I think the Log4Shell vulnerability was so easy to exploit, was so notorious, and it was easier to tell your customers, yes, we updated, than it would have been to try to explain why you think you're not vulnerable. So we use this one since then as sort of a bellwether of how quickly people update stuff, because it's as close to we should expect nearly 100% as we're ever going to see. And yet here we are almost, you know, 3 years later, and it's still 13% of the time people are downloading these known vulnerable versions. It's crazy.
Quick question. Do you have the data to show, like, are they just not updating Log4j, or are they also not updating everything else? Like, are these basically just applications that are stale?
We did do analysis on dependencies in general. We found that 80% of dependencies are unupdated year over year, which is not a good statistic. You know, looking at the worldwide trends of Log4j, because we're looking at, you know, download streams, basically, in that instance, it's a little bit hard to understand the application context and what else is actually being used alongside it. But, you know, people tend to want to think like, well, these are applications that were built and never updated. And I want to highlight, no, it's being built when it's downloading it from us.
Well, that's what I'm wondering, right?
Yeah, that's the number. And it's built by organizations that don't have a repository manager. Otherwise, we wouldn't see them downloaded a million times. So the actual usage number is probably much higher than 13%. We just don't see those downloads because they're cached locally on the repo, right?
Well, or they're just not building it ever again.
Or they're not building it again, and it might still be in use. But, you know, this is literally somebody taking the vulnerable version from Central and including it in a build on an ongoing basis. And you know, I did a lot of research earlier this year as part of the report to try and track down, you know, was it like a Spark job running a billion times on Amazon that was fetching stuff from Central? Because we see this sometimes. You know, could I put my finger on it? And the answer was no. It was massively distributed, mostly global. There was no correlation. You know, it was legitimately coming from built. And that's the sad state that we're in.
All right. I want to tie this to Tidelift now, because there is an interesting data point in the Sonatype report that says only 0.5% of components have no available update. So I assume that means of that 80%, what, 99.5% have updates, which feels like the kind of thing Donald is trying to push of getting everyone to provide updates for all their stuff feels very hand in hand in that regard.
Yes, I do think that those are two sides of the same coin. I guess maybe to put it, to restate it succinctly, the updates got to come from somewhere. There's a human process yes, involved in creating these updates for you to have the opportunity to update too. Even if you don't do that in a timely manner, as Brian just pointed out, many organizations are still too lax there. But yeah, the part of the problem that we're focused on is like, okay, where do those updates come from and why? And, you know, we, in our survey this year, the Tidelift State of the Open Source Maintainer Survey, we asked again, as we have in a couple of years past, about, you know, what kind of support do independent open source maintainers have for their open source work? How do they, you know, what are their incentives to make those updates available? And we data was pretty consistent to what we've heard the last couple of years. We heard that 12% of maintainers, you know, basically I self-identified as a professional paid maintainer, where they earn most of their income from maintaining their open source projects. About a quarter of the maintainers that we surveyed said that they consider themselves kind of a semi-professional maintainer. They earn some income from maintaining their projects, but 60% reported that they are unpaid maintainers. They don't have, they're not receiving any income related to their open source maintenance work. Now, the interesting thing is if you look into that 60%, 16% of the total said that they're unpaid and they don't want to be paid. 16 out of all of the maintainers, 16%. 44% said they're currently unpaid for their open source work, but they would like to be paid for their open source work, right? So there's almost half of the total universe of independent open source maintainers who participate in our survey said, I'm not paid and I want to be paid. So that's an opportunity, I think, to respond to that need for the availability of these updates, et cetera. That is a thing that we can go solve. And I think a nice elegant solution to that is, pull something from the pages of capitalism to align some incentives between the supply side and the demand side there.
That's one thing that's always interested me about Tidelift, because like Josh and I both work for Red Hat, and hiring open source people to do open source stuff is, I'm going to say, it's a little bit different than the usual software developer culture, and especially from a corporation. And so it's always been interesting to me that I think there is a real need for like that market maker from both the consumption and the demand side to kind of hook these things up, because, well, we've all seen what happens when companies try and deal directly with the open source people and ask them for updates. It, you know, doesn't usually end very well, or at least not politely.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and a historical note, myself and all three of my co-founders are also Red Hat alumni, you know, way back when at the dawn of Enterprise Linux, and we, you know, got the chance to get to know Josh there at least. So yeah, we definitely drew some inspiration from that in terms of, Red Hat is making a market in a certain way for a layer of the stack. Now, you know, our observation was that the exact Red Hat way of doing it, creating a long-term maintenance distribution, multiple release streams, there's a kind of impedance mismatch, sort of a socio-technical mismatch with the way that application developers prefer to consume their open source. So a different solution is necessary. And so, you know, our idea was like, hey, maybe we could just kind of twist the Red Hat model instead of hiring all these internal, you know, shadow maintainers of the upstream open source projects. What if we just ask the open source creators to do the same checklist of things or a similar checklist of things for their own projects and provide them an economic incentive to do that? Now, this actually gets to one of the most important finding in our survey this year, which comports with what we're seeing in our business. And that's that this does work. So if you compare paid maintainers to unpaid maintainers, we observe, and they also, you know, report in the survey that paid maintainers are implementing 55% more across a list of critical security and maintenance practices than unpaid developers are. And, you know, we provide a breakdown of what do I mean by critical security maintenance practices. We're talking about things like having multi-factor authentication enabled on all of the elements of the build process, you know, your source code repository, but also your community package manager if it supports that. Using code analysis tools to look for potential vulnerabilities, having a security response plan publicly in place and assignment of responsibilities for what happens and who's responsible when a new security vulnerability arises. So the bottom line, most important thing that we found is when we provide a simple, often modest economic incentive to these open source maintainers who are looking after these projects, they do undertake more of the secure development practices, which are the things that enterprises and organizations that consume this need to happen so that those updates are available for them to consume.
Okay, I want to ask you a question, Donald, and then I want to go to, I have a statistic from Brian's report that I think will tie into this question nicely, is how do you decide, like, what the bar is to decide we will pay this maintainer. Because, like, for example, I maintain a bunch of crap that I'm pretty sure I'm the only person who uses it. And I suspect Tidelift has no interest in paying me to maintain the packages only I use.
That's true. So basically, our approach is we look at, sorry, Josh.
Yeah, that's fine. I get it. I set that one up. I deserve that.
I might do a side deal with you personally because of my personal interest in your passions. But
no.
Yeah, basically, the way that we approach this is a part of our approach to the problem is that we see the software bills of material, collective software bills of material for our customers and all the applications that they're building.
Yeah.
And we look at what's getting used the most. And we prioritize building relationships with the maintainers of those open source projects that are being used the most by our customer base.
Sure.
And so we always have this sort of like efficient frontier, you can think about it, where we're like onboarding more and more projects, the next most commonly used projects. But that's how we guide our recruitment and onboarding process.
Okay, good. Okay, so that sets us up now for Brian. In the Sonatype report, this number I suspected, but you say only 10.5% of open source components are actively used out of over 7 million available. That, I mean, don't get me wrong, 700,000 is still a lot, but like that feels like a very compelling number.
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised. It's sort of, yeah, it's one of these things. It feels small and yet it doesn't at the same time. When you think about the components that people tend to use, they tend to be, you know, the more popular, the foundation supported projects, these types of things. But it's nice to see that, you know, bear out. And yeah, we looked across multiple of the ecosystems to come up with that 7 million number. And then we looked at the applications and the downloads to see what's being used. And I think when you kind of align that with like what Donald's talking about, you know, our findings found similar things. And I want to back up for a minute to provide the context. But I do think there's a glimmer of hope when you recognize that, like, we don't have to pay everybody for everything. There is a very nice set that really matters. And that might feel tractable. But one of the things that we looked at over the last 10 years was how quickly do open source publishers remediate vulnerabilities in their own dependencies? And 10 years ago, it was days to weeks. And now it's on average 300 days.
It got much worse.
It got much worse. So during that 10-year timeframe, the number of projects that are releasing faster is up 1,400%, right? So they're releasing faster, which is makes sense. That's how software is developed compared to 2014. But yeah, it's on average 300 days for an open source project to update a vulnerability that's in one of their dependencies and then do a new release. And when you compare that to what Donald was saying, they're spending three times more time working on vulnerabilities than they were before, right? So it's not that open source projects aren't trying to, they're trying to, and they're not able to keep up. And Josh, I know you've done a lot with the CVE counts and looking at, you know, the how many new vulnerabilities are coming out. And it's not a coincidence, right? The number of vulnerabilities that are out there in the world, and therefore the number of the open source maintainers have to contend with, is through the roof, right? And so they're trying harder and doing worse, frankly. But what we found when we looked at the different projects, we looked at them across a number of different dimensions, but one of the more interesting ones is, like, were these projects, you know, from a foundation, Apache, Eclipse, Linux Foundation, were they paid on the paid list from Tidelift, right? And we found that the ones that are getting the paid support are actually resolving those vulnerabilities 45% faster, and they have half the number of vulnerabilities than the other ones. And that stat actually beats the foundation support ones. You know, so foundation supported ones are better than average, but the paid maintainer ones are even better than that. Now, you know, the paid ones, probably there's a lot of them. They tend to be maybe less bureaucracy, let's say, less people involved in the project. So they might be able to be more nimble in these things, less people to cajole into doing it. But the foundations provide the governance support, but they're not like paying somebody to do their stuff on the weekend. So it's still by and large unpaid maintainers, even in a foundation type of environment. Right. So I do think when you take all that together, you know, the maintainers are struggling, they're trying harder and they're falling behind, you know, but if we can pay them, things look better. There's not that many things that need to be paid to do to have a big impact on the ecosystem. That starts to, I think, shine a path forward.
I'd love to just pick up with one point on this around the maintain the foundations, the role of foundations, because we asked specifically in our survey about this, and I think that there, I really at this point believe there's a pernicious misunderstanding of the role of open source foundations in the incentivization and payment of people who actually write software that actually work on the open source projects. So, you know, the evidence for this in the Tidelift report is bracing, actually. So we asked our, you know, 400 plus maintainers, if you're getting paid, who is paying you? And we found that 25% reported that they are receiving some payment from donation programs, kind of like GitHub sponsors, Patreon, things like that, 25%. 25% said they're getting paid in their day job, that's sort of subsidizing their open source work, okay? 19% reported they're getting paid by Tidelift. We're really proud about that, actually. That number's been ticking up over the last couple of years, so that's like what we're here to do. 3% said that they're receiving payment from open source foundations. Of the 400 plus open source maintainers of these, the most widely used projects, 3% are receiving a financial incentive from open source foundations. So I agree that open source foundations are doing something. There's like a governance role, there's good things that are coming from investments and participation in open source foundations, but essentially they're doing nothing to pay open source maintainers to incentivize, for example, secure development practices for their open source projects.
I think that's a point that's not well understood in the CRA legislation from EU as well, right? Because they created the stewards, open source steward category, which is meant to cover the foundations. And I think some of the logic behind that was, well, these guys are paying to make things better. So maybe that will be an inevitable outcome out of it, which will be a pretty big change, because not all foundations have, you know, a war chest of money to go spend in that area, but the expectation may be there nonetheless.
I want to stress that point, because if you look at the financial statements from a lot of these foundations that do open source, it is shockingly small. I mean, we like to think of like OpenSSF and Linux Foundation and Mozilla, and they've got hundreds of millions of dollars. But when you look at things like Eclipse and Apache, it is like, I don't know how they run these places on their budgets.
Literally, Apache blows my mind because it's 2.3 million, right? And they spend like, over half of that on infrastructure. And Python is 4.7 million. Like, those are, like, if you actually had to pay maintainers, you could literally have a handful of maintainers. Like, you need so much, like, add two zeros to those numbers to have enough paid maintainers for those ecosystems, right? That's what blows my mind.
The Apache one's a good example. It is kind of the bare minimum. Like, pretty much all the money is going towards supporting the infrastructure in an independent way, right? We don't pay our executive directors and all these kinds of things. You know, there's very limited paid staff there. So it is literally infra, and a lot of it is donated too. So where would money come from to pay for security audits and security enhancements across hundreds of projects? That's an unknown question.
I also want to just chip in one other view on that, a data-based view, which is these, the famous projects that have their own foundations, OpenSSF, the Apache Foundation projects, these are not the typical, they're not like the median open source project that organizations are consuming, right? There's this like dark matter, I think of it as, of all of the other open source software that's just flowing out of Maven Central or NPM or the Python Package Index into your organization. Now, we already talked about how 60% of the maintainers that we surveyed report that they're a unpaid hobbyist, although the majority of those would like to get paid related to their open source work. The related point I want to make is that we asked them, do you have co-maintainers? And among the unpaid open source maintainers, 61% reported that they are a solo maintainer of their project, right? So people like to talk about the bus factor around open source projects. My co-founder, Louis Villa, prefers the, I think, more appropriate analogy of the boss factor. What happens if this person gets hired and can't work on their open source project because they're, you know, they got a new job and they're busy. 61% of the open source maintainers are sole maintainers on their projects. So, you know, they don't, it's just not relevant. The, you know, umbrella from the foundations out there, they have no intersection point.
Yes. Yes. And there's, I know Kurt and I have talked about this at length, where the number of single maintainer projects is shockingly huge. And it is not understood at all. I mean, there's a famous issue I always link to with it at the OpenSSF. It's issue 101, where this discussion started and I started showing them data and they were like, oh, no, that's just NPM. Python's totally different. And like every way you try to slice and dice this data, it's the same thing over and over and over again. And it was like half of them, I think, had bananas in their ears and then the other half were changing their pants because it's just it's a crazy number.
Well, if you look at history, though, there's a lot of like there's a lot of smart people who've done things on their own that have changed the world. And I don't want to say software is easy to do, but software is, it's easy to have an impact if you write some good software, right? Because people will find you and download it and use it. And distribution is easy. Just stick it on GitHub and shove it into Maven or whatever, you know, ecosystem. And one thing I'm wondering is how much sort of, when people start actually looking at this, by people, I mean organizations, do they find a lot of sort of shadow IT? And I don't mean shadow IT in like a malicious way, but more shadow IT in a, oh my God, what? Why is this pulling in so many dependencies? Like, I thought you were just writing, you know, a simple app to do a web interface. And, you know, of course, 1,000 NPM later. Is that a thing people are starting to become aware of now with the whole SBOM and the whole actually using tools that monitor what's going on?
I think it's less of a shock factor than it was when we first started. I mean, we had conversations with CIOs who are like, we're not using open source. And it's like, oh, right? It's laughable, but it's like, oh, really? Your organization is the biggest consumer of open source Java from Central in the whole world. You know, clearly you are. And the fact that you don't know it is a gap. That was a real conversation that happened probably 13 years ago. These things still happen, but I think it's more generally understood that that's the case. The scale of it might still shock people. You know, NPM is like 10 to 100x the number of dependencies you see in Java, just because the modules are more like, imagine if all the Java modules were one class each, right? You would see an explosion in a number, you know? And so I think just understanding how complex it is something that maybe people only are scratching the surface of.
I do see evidence of people still getting surprised by this, though. And I mean, a concrete example I can give is, you'll remember that after the Log4Shell episode, there was this big government reaction response. They formed for the first time ever a cybersecurity safety review board, CSRB, kind of modeled on the, you know, space shuttle transportation security board kind of model. So I actually was at an event a couple of years ago when this happened, where the CIO of the US Department of Defense was on stage, and he was talking about how he had been tapped to be one of the commissioners of this the CSRB, the Cybersecurity Safety Review Board, to look into the circumstances of Log4Shell and what happened. And what I heard him say on stage is that he was amazed to find out that so much of the software that they're using is made by random volunteers on the internet that the US Department of Defense is using, right? So that was in that sense, it was presented as a revelation. And, you know, we refer to this category overall as software supply chain security. I mean, what organization is a more sophisticated supply chain discipline than the US Department of Defense? They are literally a supply. I mean, the thing that they are is a supply chain, and even they had not really had the right level of scrutiny or awareness, certainly at the highest levels of the organization. I mean, whoever's typing, you know, NPM install probably understands this intuitively that this stuff is flowing in, although maybe they don't think that much about it. But I think at the senior ranks, until these episodes like Log4Shell and XEUtils come to pass and make headlines, people just, they don't want to look at that because it's the more they learn about it, the more concerned they are. And now they have to deal with it.
So I have two statistics I can lend to this conversation. So no one knows this yet. You two are getting the, I guess, kind of preview is Anchor's supply chain report that we put out last in 2022. We're putting it out. We're recording on a Wednesday. It's coming out on Thursday. This episode will come out on Sunday. So I'm not leaking to the world, but in that, only 20% of organizations said they're very confident in knowing what all their dependencies are. And like, yeah, we're how many years, what, 3 years past Log4Shell? And I mean, my guess is, I don't think we asked this in 2022, but it was certainly not 20%. But we have a long freaking way to go.
I think that number is shockingly low. Not because I believe that is an inaccurate number, but because most people think they know it and they don't. I don't remember the stat offhand, but we also did an intersection with the Finos report, the financial open source LF organization. They did a report right at the same time. I was calling it our report trifecta. And I think they surveyed basically the same thing. And I think their answer was sort of like 45%. And I challenged that with like,
yeah, no way.
They that's what they think they're doing that. I have data to show that they're not. So Josh, your 22% number sounds probably more accurate and is surprising to me only because people seem incredibly self-aware in your data set in a way that I haven't seen before. So that's cool.
So there's another piece to that number. Is another question that we did ask in 2022 was, you know, is supply chain your top priority, software supply chain? And in 2022, 8% said yes. And in 2024, 24% said yes. So like at least that's going up and to the right and quite quickly, which is good. Hopefully in two more years, we're at 50%, which is optimistic, I suspect, but
riffing off of that for a moment, you know, you brought up the 700,000 number, the 10.5% of open source is used. That number's around 700,000. One of the things we've been tracking is the rise of what I'll call the intentionally malicious open source packages. These are packages that are typo squatted or what have you, for the express purpose of doing harm. They're basically a phishing attack on your developers, right? This year, as of a couple months ago, that number was also 700,000. So as we're sitting here recording right now, the number of known intentionally malicious components almost certainly exceeds the number of components that are typically used in software these days. So the signal to noise ratio is now worse than 1-to-1. And that I think is a really interesting milestone.
Okay. So like, for example, I remember a time of email where I did not have spam filters because there was no spam. And now, you know, what, 98 to 99.6 or something percent of email is spam. So, and I've often wondered this, because creating an open source package and, you know, that's malicious and uploading it to an ecosystem is cheap, like on the order of seconds of effort. It can be mostly scripted, blah, blah, blah. So yeah, what happens when that signal to noise ratio or that malicious package to non-malicious package is 10-to-1 or 100-to-1? Like what? Well, like I just, because this is something I've, you know, every time I think about it, I just sort of get a headache and decide not to think about it. But it would appear that it's going to become an issue, whether we like it or not.
Yeah, I mean, I think hopefully by then we'll finally start to solve it. I mean, this is an area that we've been helping our customers solve since like 2018 when I first started talking about it. You know, we didn't have a good answer to it back then. I was highlighting a problem and that we hadn't solved, so we closed that gap. But I think it's a not well understood thing in our space. So part of the flip answer is when it gets to 10-to-1, maybe we'll finally like see, you know, people caring about this problem in a way we don't know. But I think the fact that we're seeing so many of these growing so fast is evidence that it's successful. The attackers are smart too. They're not going to waste their time doing something that doesn't get payback. The fact that it continues to grow, you know, that growth was 150% over last year. So it was 250,000 the year before. So we're growing, we're still like basically doubling on really big numbers year over year at this point. And that just shows the ecosystem's not addressing it and it's effective for them. So I think we're going to trend in the wrong direction.
Kurt, I love the analogy to the email spam problem there. And I've never really thought about it in that way. But what occurs to me now is that there's a couple of different complementary solutions to the email spam problem, right? One is train a machine learning model to identify things that look like they're spam because they're talking about certain topics or they're, you know, written a certain way.
I actually ran an email server for a mortgage broker and it was a nightmare. Trying to tune Spam Assassin to not kill all their outgoing email was a disaster.
Okay, so the Spam Assassin approach, which is you're only looking at the information that's in the message payload, right? So that's like trying to filter an open source repository just by looking at the package metadata as published, right? So the approach that has, I believe, kind of, you know, largely massively improved the complementary approach in the email spam context is sender authentication, right? Like actually having the digital signatures. I forget all of the acronyms for the protocols here, but you know, there's these sender authentication regimes that that significantly have improved the situation. It's because you're going one step ahead, further back from the actual payload and getting some kind of assurance from the creator, the publisher of that. They have to go through an authentication process and so on. So I believe that is a good analogy here and a good inspiration for how we can approach this problem around the, you know, the malicious packages and open source project repositories. Let's not just like look at each one of them and try to say malicious, not malicious. Let's actually connect to the process further up, have some kind of a relationship and an incentive to not be malicious and to be malicious, you know, actively, you know, resilient to malice, you know, among the publishers, understand who they are and actually incorporate, bring the humans into the solution as well as just fancier and fancier, you know, machine learning models. So cool analogy. I like that one.
Well, and it also speaks to the, it has to be efficient. Like we can't have people reviewing open source packages or even, you know, like again, at 700,000 scale and then some multiple of that being malicious. Because the thing is like, okay, some of it, you know, is really old and like PyCurl. PyCurl's probably fine. But there are a perfect example. I do a lot of PDF parsing to get text out of PDFs, especially with tables. God bless PDF for tables. And like all the old stuff is garbage now. And the new stuff that does like OCR and uses PyTorch and everything is fantastic. And it's all like 3 months old. And so is it like a new malicious thing or is it a new innovative approach that's totally new? You know, and I've had to vet some of these projects and that I'm barely able to do for myself for one package that I need. And so, yeah, I'm looking at how do I scale this? And the answer is I have no idea. So I'm glad that you guys are working on it.
This is how ultimately we chose to solve it way back several years ago, because we recognized that each new type of attack was somewhat novel. You couldn't look in the mirror. You were always playing catch up. And we recognized the problem looks a lot like credit card fraud detection, that you can't make at the moment somebody is trying to authorize a transaction, you can't necessarily know that they're fake or not, but you can build a stereotype of each of us as consumers, the type of consumer we are, and then make a decision, right? So, you know, when I first started traveling, sometimes my card would get blocked because I went to a gas station. That doesn't happen anymore because that's normal for me. But you know what I don't do? I don't go to Walmart on the other side of the country and try to buy a whole bunch of TVs. You know, that would be unusual. And so we've all kind of gotten used to this model with our credit card companies will text us in the moment if we do something that's in retrospect a little bit unusual with our credit card or if it is legitimate spam. And so we started building MLAI models around project metadata, the committers. And it's interesting the way that worked. But we've been doing that since like 2018. And that's how we found most of these malicious packages. And the really interesting success story was, you guys probably remember the dependency confusion research that came out a few years ago, right? So this was a white hat figured out that if I publish something to say NPM with a module name that I know a company is using internally, but I use a higher version number, yep, then the build tool might not know, and it's just going to prefer mine. And he, you know, famously, I think like Tesla and a bunch of other companies were, you know, paying bug bounties on this. Well, this was the same time that we were testing our system internally, and our system was flagging all of his research components before it was published. And he left enough breadcrumbs that we were able to reach out and actually confirm it was in fact a white hat. But in retrospect, what was happening? It was very unusual for a new project to appear on the scene with a version number like 1000. We didn't have to program the system to that. Most of the other tools trying to do this after that research was out created heuristics to do that after it happened, but our system was flagging it before that was known to be a pattern, simply because it was an anti-pattern for what is normal behavior of components. So that's how we've chosen to solve it, and it's been successful beyond my wildest dreams. I had no idea how many of these we were going to find, and we started finding them right away.
Nice. All right, it's time to bring it home, gentlemen. So I'll start with Brian, but fill us with optimism and hope, Brian. What does the future look like?
Optimism and hope.
We especially need it today.
Yeah. I think, perversely, I am somewhat optimistic because of some of the legislation that's finally coming. You know, I've been trying to educate and inform people about this problem for like 15 years under the false thinking that they just don't understand, they just don't see. I now recognize that it's not an information problem, it's a motivation problem in many of these things. And so I think, you know, the liability reform in Europe, the CRA in Europe, some of those things, I think will finally begrudgingly get organizations to do the right thing, because they're going to have to be responsible for the final outcome to make sure it's safe, regardless of if they check the right boxes or not. And I think it's, that's really the last mile. Otherwise, you see what we see today, where people are going through, you know, best practices, or, you know, you see them trying to get to vulnerability zero, as I think you coined, Josh, you know, like going through the motions of doing these things without really thinking about what the implications are. So that's my reason for optimism. Of all reasons, regulation. And it's tough to say that, but that's where I'm at.
Awesome. All right, Donald, bring it home, man.
So my optimistic note to start with, I want to go a little bit deeper into the crevasse first and just point out that one of the bottom line findings in our survey is that 60% of the open source maintainers that we surveyed said that they have quit or considered quitting their open source project and leaving it unabandoned. 60%.
Yes, which is terrifying.
It's really, you know, that's like your supply chain suppliers saying we're on the verge of going away. And when we ask them, what do you not like about being an open source maintainer? Obviously, there's many things that are appealing. What are the unappealing parts? The top three are, I'm not financially compensated enough, I feel underappreciated, and it adds to my personal stress. Okay. So my note of optimism is, these are things that we can address as participants in this value exchange, as organizations that consume open source. If maintainers are frustrated because they're not financially compensated, we can financially compensate them. If they feel underappreciated or like their work is thankless, we can say thank you and just simply register appreciation. And if they feel that it's adding to their personal stress, we can help carry the load by supporting them and doing some of the work, you know, Brian referred to foundations and, you know, some of the organizations do around governance, et cetera. So these things are addressable. There's tools in the marketplace. Some of them are new, you know, Tidelift, we're trying to advance certainly that financial compensation element, but it is available. And so my note of optimism is, while the situation may feel dire, there are paths up out of this, you know, pit that we're in. All we need to do is choose to undertake those paths with optimism.
It sounds so simple when you say it. All right. Awesome. Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Don. Thank you, Kurt. This has been amazing. So I want to say thank you ever for listening. You go to opensourcesecuritypodcast.com for the show notes. I'll put links to the reports and Donald and Brian and companies and all that stuff. And use the PoundOSS podcast hashtag on Mastodon. Kurt, Donald, and Brian, have a marvelous rest of your day.
You too. Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.